And welcome to Observations. I'm here with Kirk, and we'll be joined by Scott later in the program. Hello, Kirk.
Good morning.
So I understand, Professor Kirk, you're going to continue to walk us through some of the discoveries that you found that you thought were interesting pertaining to the promises made to Yisrael, as well as the location of Yisrael, where the Yisraelites have gone, how we know they have gone there. And really, how God is going to recognize who they are and bring them back home at the proper time.
Right. Well, you know, Yahweh never lost them, but he knew where they were.
He certainly dispersed them. I mean, he had help.
Yeah.
I'm not sure these were helpers he wanted to work with, but they were the those that... That certainly assisted in the disbursement. You could call them Assyrians and Babylonians and Greeks and Persians and Romans and Romans and Roman Catholics. And then, of course, they had some help in later days from Germans and from the Brits and a few others that, and of course, the Muslims, all who have taken a hand of scattering them, and there's a lot of just anti-Semites that want to obliterate any knowledge of them other than to blame them.
Yeah. Well, Yahweh made some prophecies about what would happen to these people, and we reviewed a tiny little bit last time about 26, 4 or 26.
And by the way, the last of his prophecies regarding these people do not end with their experience in the Holocaust.
Not at all.
Doesn't even end with him calling them back to their homeland, to Yisrael.
Yeah.
Now, the last prophecies regarding them go right up to his return and thereafter. I mean, they play a huge role in the 1,000 years after his return. But there are probably more predictions about what's going to happen to Yehudah and Yisrael over the next 10 to 15 years than there have been collectively all the way along up to this point.
Well, to make that point, what I wanted to do today was go through all the tribes, tell them what God said about them.
Right.
And both in 49 and also in Dabarim 33.
Yeah, and tribe, by the way, is not really the best. It's not the best term. I know that's the way that the word is rendered, but and in the ancient world, groups of people who were part of extended families were called tribes. In fact, in the Islamic world, throughout the Middle East, it's extraordinarily tribal today, Throughout Africa, there's a lot of tribal kinds of behavior. And if you look at Europe in terms of ruling families and the aristocrats, the lords, if you will, that would be tribal in the sense of hereditary, you know, who you're related to. And so we're in a more modern nomenclature, we should really think of, from which part of the family are you derived? Are you the offspring of, in this case, Dan or Yehudah? So they're not so much independent tribes as they are part of the family tree.
Right. Branches, if you like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Be good. But what was interesting, just pertaining to what you just mentioned, when you start out at 49.1, Bar-Rashid 49.21, it says, and Jacob, called to his sons, and he said, gather yourself together to make known to you that which you will encounter or what will befall you in the last days. Well, you know, this is way back.
Yeah, and the last days. He's not talking about what's going to occur when. Yeah, this is not when they return to Israel from Egypt.
No.
He's not talking about what's going to happen. Yeah.
Being
not the 700s BCE under the Assyrians. Not the 500 BCE under the Babylonians. This is not what's going to happen under before that with under Dode and Solomon. This is not what's going to happen under the Greeks, although he would tell them that. Not what's going to happen under the Romans, although he would tell them that as well. Or the Roman Catholics. He wasn't sparse in his predictions regarding them. Or under the even under the Germans or the British Mandate. No, this is in the end of days.
Right.
Have the end of days arrived?
Yeah. No, they're very close.
So that means it is yet in our future. That means that there has to be a remnant, a genuine remnant, descendants of this original cast of characters, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would suggest to you it's more than just a remnant, but there's quite a lot of them. But of all the family tree, there's some very large numbers and some that are quite small. What I wanted to review... And
collectively, would you guess that number might be in the range of 15 million?
Well, of Yehuda, yes.
Oh, you think just of Yehuda it's 15 million?
Oh, yeah.
So you think that the number of Yisraelites is significantly greater
Otherwise, then Yah has lied to us. He said they're going to be a huge, huge number.
Okay, well, 15 million is a pretty good size number.
I saw in those, yeah.
And when you talk about only thousands are part of his covenant, I view 15 million as a pretty significant number.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, particularly of the residents of Jerusalem, Magog war, they're going to be decimated.
Oh yeah. America's going to be decimated, and that's where, that England will be decimated. The Western Europeans will be decimated. If there's a nuclear holocaust, if there's a nuclear war.
Yeah, although the Jews do not succumb to the nuclear war, Magog war, they succumb to the swords and bombs and bullets of raging jihadists.
Well, I'm not talking about in Israel, but I'm talking about if Russia and America start attacking one another after the fact,
mm-hmm.
after that, then you have Apophis and all that. You've wiped out half of the world's population.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm referring to, I've been translating, Yeshaya, Isaiah 5, and there's a line in there where God is saying that there's a uniform cry from Yehuda and Yisrael out of Jerusalem. And then he explains the reason for the cry, which is that it gets so sparse that for every 10 acres of land, mm-hmm. there is but one daughter.
It.
So that's that is indeed decimated.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't get worse. And it doesn't get any better. What I've been studying and reading and everything, it's easy to trace the northern kingdom of Israel, where they went and where they became. And mm-hmm. there was a remnant of Yehuda and Benjamites, and the Loi went with them as well.
Mm-hmm.
All of them, some of them were found up there too as well in the northern tribes, and as well as mm-hmm. there's some of all the remnants that were still stayed with in the southern kingdom.
Yeah. And by the way, Yahweh never says that of the 10 tribes that comprise the northern kingdom, also referred to as Ephraim, and at other times independently Yisrael, because Yahweh separates Yisrael from Yehuda, which, by the way, always leaves kind of Dan out there dangling, because mm-hmm. Dan is not part of Yehuda. Yet they're not. They're also not part of the Northern Kingdom. So they're kind of out there in no man's land. But Yahweh never says that the Northern Kingdom, those 10 tribes, are somehow obliterated.
No, they weren't obliterated.
No. As a matter of fact, I don't even think he used the term they're lost. They're, he just says that they were hauled away as slaves with rings in their noses by the Assyrians, the very Assyrians who tried then to do the same thing with Yehuda surrounding Jerusalem. But Hezekiah figured out, you know, if we observe Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkurim, and we get rid of all the religious paraphernalia, and if we stop relying on men and start relying on God, they can't touch us. But it just says they were hauled away into slavery by the Assyrians, and it makes no mention of them returning until really it's a collective return of Yisrael and Yehuda in the last days.
Yeah. But they kept on going. When Assyria fell, mm-hmm. the Persians took over and they offered them a chance to go back to Israel, and they didn't want to go. And mm-hmm. I find that so remarkable, because Yahweh gave them a land. He gave every one of them a piece of land.
Keep this in mind. Israel, the northern kingdom, was in wholesale rebellion against Yahweh very early on. Yahweh divorced himself of them long before he divorced Yehuda. And I'm not even sure he ever really formally divorces Yehuda. He certainly divorces the northern kingdom. Mm-hmm. And they had become overtly religious. And they weren't practicing Judaism. They're practicing a religion that's the kissing cousin to Christianity.
Right.
And all around them, the religion was a religion that's almost identical to Islam today. So Islam and Christianity in their original forms were prevalent. And so there really isn't any reason to think that they would want to come back to the promised land, because they had forgotten all about the promises. And they had replaced the real God with one of the religious fakes.
That's what bothers me.
Yeah, but that's what they had done, and they also knew that that little strip of land that is Yisrael, when it has Yahweh's oversight and blessing, it is the most wonderful place, the most coveted place in the world. But it's also at the crossroads of Asia, Africa, and Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, every army that of any consequence that ever marched went through there.
But if they were doing what he asked them to do, he promised them, "I'll protect you from all the wild beasts. I'll protect mm-hmm, you from
yep.
every enemy.
Yep. I'll make you the envy of the world."
Yeah. So it's not.
Yeah.
it's a trust.
Why do you think that any of them remembered that?
Well, I know they wouldn't, and I know they didn't, but it just seems such
a waste.
Read this stuff, you just go, what is wrong? Well, same thing when you happen to the
what is wrong
with you people?
In Yeshaya 5, after Yahweh explains that he has this marvelous vineyard that he has prepared, and that the vineyard represents the house of Yisrael, he asks Yisrael, because he says, listen, I did everything that I thought I could do. What more could I have done?
Yes.
Because I anticipated rational thinking and good responses, and what I got was viciousness and bloodshed and condemnation and all manner of bad things.
Yeah.
And he says, so what could I have done differently? What would you have had me do differently? So it's the same situation. You know, when you realize who's making the offer and what he's offering, you'd have to be pretty stupid to say no, but hasn't virtually everyone, all but one in a million, have said no?
Yes. It's just, I know this is, we go over this all the time, and it seems kind of funny that you don't, I get it.
Yeah. For example, Yeshaya 5, as Yahweh begins, he begins with pleas, telling us that he wants to sing a song. Now, Yahweh is free. He can go sing a song, right? So if he's beginning with pleas, the pleas is because he wants us to listen.
Yeah.
And for better part of 2,700 years, he couldn't find anybody who wanted to listen. Here he wants to sing this love song, and no one wants to listen to him.
That is just...
Oh, it tears your heart out.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it tears your heart. It's heartbreaking. Absolutely. A song of unrequited love.
You know, this is also in Quora 26. You know, I know you're working on that, but pertaining back to this just a minute. I did a little synopsis because it's 46 verses, so it's a lot. And I
That's
encourage anybody to read it, even in a... In a Masoretic text, most of the translations, you can get the gist of it without, and then you can cut the words apart, which I did. But Yahweh just offers the blessings to Israel, in a little synopsis form. He offers the blessings to Israel, Israel, and he tells them the conditions and the consequence of rejecting his offer. He lays it all out. And then there's a curse to all the tribes. And but it's a special. There's a special seven times curse to the tribes of Israel. He does it. He mentions it four times. He's very serious. That's a time of testing.
Yeah, four times.
Seven times the curse, and so you've got. That's how we come to the 2,520 years. And then he concludes on. But he says, you know, even there at the very end of it, he says that on the days of Yom Kippurim. On the last days, he'll remember Zakar. He'll remember them because his because of his covenant, his familial family agreement. I mean, he does this throughout the entire Torah. And but if you read 26, if you read 26, so much of it is, I'll make you fruitful. I'll make you protected. I will do this. I will do that. I'm doing everything in the world to make your garden grow, basically, to make your vineyards grow. Just like in 5:1, Yahweh repeats himself over and over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
But he does tell you what the consequences are, and he does tell you very specifically what's going to happen to you if you don't.
Right.
And that's kind of where I started with all this stuff. It was on 26. And then I got into the, what did he promise to each of the tribes or each of the groups of people known as Israel? We covered Reuben before, and Reuben, of course, he had... two distinctive characteristics. He was being a man acting stupid. He was the firstborn. And Dabarim 21:17 won't allow you to take his double portion away, but and Yahweh doesn't. But when Jacob is talking and passing on the blessing, he tells him, you know, you were my firstborn and this, that, and the other, but you did some terrible things. And I'm going to, and you're not going to be... you're not going to be a king. You're not going to be the firstborn to inherit everything. But you will have a good inheritance regardless because Dabarim insists that you must do that for him. But he doesn't become a king, but he does become powerful. And in Dabarim 33, which is the other thing where Moses now is talking about these tribes as they send them off into the promised land, he tells him that it's pretty nice. He says, may Reuben live and not die. Nor his men be few. And basically, he's told them all the way through these two sections, both 49 of Barashith and Dabarim 33. He'll still be a leader, but he won't be a prominent king. So if you're looking for where Reuben goes, and that's really what the journey is.
Right, and you've got to have a lot of them now.
You've got to, well, you've
they can't be,
them,
they can't be lost. They can't be gone in the sense of obliterated.
No. He didn't obliterate them. He let them grow and grow and grow. This is a large body of people. Now, the ones I wanted to do, there's obviously there's 13 groups of people here, but there's only about seven of them that are really, really important to this study so that we don't put everybody to sleep, or I don't put everybody to sleep. So Reuben we've covered. Judah is the one I wanted to go to next because that's really paramount about where we all started from, talking about Yehuda and what the promises were, as if they were somehow, the Christian world seems to believe that they were taken away. And as you go, if anybody wants to look it up, it's plain writing, 49:8, he says, he promises him that your brothers, Judah, Yehuda, your brothers will praise you. They will give thanks and acknowledge you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's son shall Your father's sons shall revere or respect you. I'm sorry, I'm changing it because they like to say bow and worship and all that sort of stuff, which is not the proper translation.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes on 49:9. He says, Yehuda is a young lion from the prey. My son, you have gone up to... Well, let's see. Let me paraphrase just a minute. Yehuda's a young... He mentions three times in 49:9. He calls him a lion three times. One, he's a young lion. Then he is a crouched lion. And he also is an old lion. And when he crouches and he lies down as a lion, it says, who dares to rouse him up? This is a powerful symbol, and that symbol goes along with Yehuda as part of his emblem.
By the way, the same references to lions make it into Yeshayah 5.
Oh, yeah.
All three
of them. All the way through Dode and all the way wherever you find Yehuda, that's what you'll find is their symbol.
Yeah.
49:10, this is the part where we have the scepter. He says, the scepter shall not depart from Judah. It doesn't say Yehuda. That rules out any chance of it going. It never says it will go anywhere else. It will not depart from Judah. The staff and the ruler's staff or between will stay between his feet until Shiloh comes. And Shiloh is always referenced as Yom Kippur, the end when Yahweh returns, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to him shall be, and let's see. So he promises him the scepter, and he promises the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they call it the law, so don't get confused about that, because Torah is not law, it's teaching. I'm talking to the audience now, so remember, that's what the two promises. But I can never find anywhere where it says he will not keep that with Judah, Yehuda. So that's total nonsense, if you think otherwise.
Yeah, you think that the keys of the kingdom are given to the Roman Catholic Church, you've been deceived.
Yeah, well, the entire church world, every Christian believes it is some sort of transfer of all this goes to them.
Authority, right.
Because their Jesus died, you know.
No. Yeah, no, I'm sorry.
If they don't change a jot and a tittle, that means they change a jot and a tittle.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, the authority, Yahweh's authority on earth remains with Yehuda. It's never been taken away, will never be taken away.
So, as a follow-up, and it's interesting, well, Moshe is a little bit, he's very nice to these, because he's starting out fresh. He sent them off into the promised land. So he says, hear Yahweh, the voice of Yehuda, and bring him unto his people, and let his hand be sufficient, and contend or strive for them. And may you, Yah, be helpful against help him against his adversaries. So he promises to protect Yehuda no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you can walk away from any promise. Now, when we were talking before, there was a little chart where we had where they lay out the tribes throughout their march through the desert. And you had on one side, you had a prominent player in each. One of them was Dan. One of them was Reuben. One of them, and there was two other groups with each one of these, and the Lowy were in the middle, of course. And then you had, and you had Reuben, you had Dan, you had Yehuda, and over to the west side we had Ephraim.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll cover Dan just a minute because he's pretty interesting as well, and he comes into play on tracing these people. Dan also is called a lion's whelp, a young lion, although that symbol is always a secondary symbol and most of the time is forgotten for all purposes. Dan is, let's see, let's go to Dan 49:16 if you want to read along with us.
Mm-hmm.
His attributes, his characteristics are he's a judge and administrator. He shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. So he's a rather important one.
Mm-hmm.
And Dan shall be a serpent, a snake in the way, in the derrick in the way, and a horned snake viper in the path of a horse's heel, so that the rider falls backwards.
Wow.
That's not a real pleasant thing to talk about him. He's calling him a serpent. But he is a powerful leader, and wherever you find him, and I might suggest to you that just looking ahead, that Dan, there's a place called Danmark, or Denmark, where the Danes are, and they happen to carry all the same symbols that the House of Dan had.
Hmm.
So that the writer falls backwards, it says, and in 49:18, wait, and he...
Not quite as strong, though, as Iberia and the Iberian Peninsula, of course.
Yeah, there's some...
for Hebrew, which is Iber, in Hebrew and Spain. But still, Dan in Denmark is it's pretty strong.
The Mark of Dan, well, the thing is, what we're going to find in just a minute, once we get through these four or five, we'll look at what their symbols are. And what they used as their banners, and then we'll see if we can trace them anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll find that most of them are pretty easily traced, and this is through archaeology and stuff that's been going on since the 1800s. And in 49:18, it says, "I wait for your salvation, Yahweh." And that was the end of the 49 part on Dan. Now, I want to throw in, they're not necessarily in order, but I want to throw in this one as well, Benjamin. Because Shaul is a big deal in all this.
Yes.
He is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he devours his prey, and in the evenings he divides it. And that's 49:27. That's a horrible thing to say about somebody. But Benjamin was never said, very little was ever said good about Benjamin. And I suspect that's because of Shaul.
Well, particularly during his birth. I mean, his mother, Rachel, died giving birth. And Rachel said, you know, this thing that is in me, I don't want to call him Benjamin. Yeah, I want to call him evil. This is really pure evil that is festering inside of me. And it killed her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Dan's our Benjamin. Is an extraordinarily dangerous animal. And, of course, the two most famous Benjamites of all time are King Saul, who Yahweh said, by choosing him, the people are rejecting me. And he was not only killed and got his family killed, but many Israelites killed along with him. And then the most infamous Benjamite of all time is the wannabe apostle, Shaul, known to Christians as Paul.
I was concerned when I read Dabarim the first time, the first read through on 33:12, which is Moshe talking about Benjamin.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, may the beloved of Yahweh dwell in security by him, who shields him all the day, and he dwells between his shoulders. First, I thought he was, the first look over, I was trying to say, well, is he saying something nice about Benjamin? And he really isn't. You know who's next to Benjamin?
Oh, of course. Yeah, Yehuda.
Yehuda.
Yeah.
And they protect him. And in fact, they merge with him. In fact, you don't find the symbol that Shaul used, or Benjamin used, was wolf.
Right.
He didn't have any secondary symbols. He just had one symbol. It's a wolf.
Mm-hmm.
Amazingly, we do find it in places in Europe, and it's interesting. But when you look on a map of where Benjamin was placed, it's right next to just a little north of Jerusalem, I believe, just above Judah territory, in the shoulders in those mountains up there, because they were raiders as well. If you came to those mountains, you either had to pay tribute or they'd steal whatever you had. He just wasn't a nice fella at all. He never, that group was something else. So then let's do the Loi, because the Loi are one of the seven is pretty important to grasp the story, make it easy to follow.
Mm-hmm.
The Loi are, let me see if I can find the 49. Well, let's do 33. Forgive my notes a little bit here at the moment. Dabarim 33:10, talking of the Loi, they were commissioned to teach the Mishpat, which is the Shofar, the statutes and the judgments to Yaakov.
And the Mishpat is the means to exercise good judgment and the means to resolve disputes. The Mishpat.
That was what they were supposed to do, and they were supposed to do it to Yaakov and to your Torah, your teaching, instruction, directions, guidance to Israel, all the tribes, and they shall put incense and spices before you and to the and entire offerings on your altar. And then in 11 says, Yahweh blessed the substance and accept the works of their of his hands. We're talking about Loi.
Mm-hmm.
And hands, and shatter the loins and the body and the heart of those who rise up against him and those who hate him, so that they will not rise again. Well, that's a pretty good blessing.
Mm-hmm.
The Loi don't prove to be very reliable either, unfortunately. They have problems, but they kept the scepter, and they did. They kept the records,
mm-hmm.
so that we can find them, and they did store them in places where, even when everything went south.
Yeah, unfortunately, they were hoodwinked out of power during the Maccabean period, when the Greeks, after the death of Alexander, came to control Israel out of Egypt, out of Mitzrayim, and there was an uprising where religious men thought that they had a better idea than God, rather than having a specific group of people through hereditary that were going to oversee the people's participation in the Mishpat, the means to resolve disputes. No, they wanted the power, and they wanted power allocated based upon their perceived ability, their own perceptions of themselves, their own accomplishments is how they wanted power to be allocated. And so from that point on, the priesthood in Yisrael is not comprised of Loi, but of any Yisraelite successfully vying for power.
Mm-hmm. It's just priesthood. I mean, they did it when it came back from Babylon.
Yes.
Now they found out this is a good gig.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden it's a monetary gig as well. And
mm-hmm.
a powerful gig.
But it stayed with the Loi through about 300 BCE. And then at that point, under the influence of the Maccabean revolt, it transferred to just to the most enlightened, the most powerful, the most influential individual.
Or who could pay the biggest bribe?
Yeah, we had socialism.
Yeah, socialism. How wonderful.
Yeah.
There's another tribe, and it starts mm-hmm. out with a blessing in 49:22. It starts out with a blessing of Joseph. And even though Joseph, he has two sons, and we talk mostly about those two, it's worth reading what he says to Joseph. He says, number one, he's going to be a fruitful bough, many thousands of children, in essence, as the enemies attack him, but he stands firm. In Dabarim, when Moshe is given his blessing, he says, blessed of Yahweh be his land, with choice things of heaven, from the dew, from the deep subterranean waters lying beneath. Also under the heavens, under the authority and control, on the subject to his conquest, transfer, I'm translating here, a little bit, transfer to, and you could also say is transfer to another place. And then in 33:14, and with the choice yield of the sun and the choice produce of the month. Now, I was reading that, and these are blessings about where they wind up, of course, in the Promised Land, and he will produce a lot of children. He'll produce a big family, because that's what he promised in another one that we did the other day,
mm-hmm.
where there'd be multiple peoples, the largest, the sands of the same as sands on the shore. And with that choice yield of the sun, that's Shemesh. And I looked that up, and it says the east side battlements.
Mm-hmm.
But it also says an object of worship, usually the sun or the moon. And Beth Shemesh is a sun temple.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a clue, don't you think, that is of what he ultimately became. They became the sun worshipers.
Mm-hmm.
They became, you know, the golden calf and
right.
so forth.
Well, that's Christianity. Christianity is a sun god religion.
Yeah. Then if you go a little bit further, and we have Ephraim, you go to Dabarim 33:17, and you have, he's talking about both Ephraim and Manasseh, but Ephraim first. As the firstborn of his ox, his majesty is in him, and his horns are the horns of a wild ox. With them he will push the peoples all at once to the ends of the earth. And those are the tens of thousands of Ephraim, and they are those of the thousands of Manasseh. I thought that's kind of interesting, because if you could find Ephraim and you have a large body of people that are very powerful, mm-hmm. to worship sun gods, mm-hmm. you might find the people who also push everybody to the ends of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Now Manasseh, you'd be the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to have a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to have with these characteristics. But one of the things that was most helpful in the study is that these people all had banners, and God told them to put their banners in place Bar Midbar 2:2, where Yahweh tells them to how to lay their tents out, or how to lay their group out in the when they're marching across and they're setting up at night when they're marching through the desert. And as you recall, on those you have, interesting enough, once again, I think we talked about it, but I'll add it again. On the west side, you have Ephraim, who is connected to Manasseh, his brother. And you also have Benjamin there. He's not next to Yehuda, where you would thought he would have been found.
Mm-hmm.
And over here, you have, on the east side, of course, you have Yehuda and Zebulun and Yeshua, and Asher and Dan and Naphtali in the north, and Reuben and Simon and Gad in the south, and the Lowi in the center.
Mm-hmm.
So where each one of these people had to put their banners out in front of their tents or their little groups. And all of those banners happen to be the ones that we're talking about, that we just described, that Jacob has described and told them what kind of characteristics they have. So what you had was, and I'll just do the ones that we covered today. Reuben,
mm-hmm.
obviously, his primary emblem is that of a man. His secondary emblem is
right.
a body of water, because he was wishy-washy. He was settled around water. He gets tossed to and fro.
Mm-hmm.
And then Yehuda, of course, was a lion.
Mm-hmm.
And it was usually a lion crouched and not reared up. We covered that on the ones that used the reared mm-hmm. up ones, and that was Zorite, Yehuda family line. But the three lions, the secondary emblems were the three lions, and they were all crouched, and then there was also a scepter and a grapevine. I always like that grapevine, especially since you're working on it right now with 5:1 and
mm-hmm.
Through 5:12 of Yashia. Dan was a serpent, and that was his primary emblem that he would display. And there were secondary emblems. One is a horse and one is a lion, but that really started to disappear. And an eagle. Manasseh was an olive branch, and his secondary emblems were a bundle of arrows and the number 13.
Gee, I wonder who he's talking about now.
Yeah, well, I'm going to show you. This is really fun.
Olive branch, number 13. Okay, push people around.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Very aggressive.
Yes.
Gee.
Ephraim.
Who might that be?
He's a bull.
Mm-hmm.
His secondary was a unicorn, but think horn, but it's always a horn, which is power. The British Empire is extraordinarily powerful. And guess what? Everywhere you go, they have adopted Ephraim. They have adopted either Ephraim or Yehuda, or the kingship of Yehuda, which they don't deserve, but they do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
In America, though, this is really fascinating. If you look at the, and you'll have to look this up online somewhere, but just go look at Emblem of the United States. And what do you suspect you're going to find?
The emblem of the United States?
Yeah. That was the early emblem of the
United States. Yeah, how about 13 stars?
Well, it has, if you look at the, well, let's move to this great seal of the United States. You can find
okay.
it very easily. You have an eagle in the center, a
mm-hmm.
single eagle, not a double eagle like you find in Russia and Germany and so forth, where the czars are and the
mm-hmm.
czars are, or the Caesars. But you have, over the crest, over the top of it, you have the 13 stars,
Mm-hmm.
It happened to be arranged in the Shield of Adode, which is sometimes called the Star of David, but it was the, I was talking to Jeff to see what he actually knew about it as well. But it's the Shield, it's referred to most often in the olden days as the Shield of Adode.
Mm-hmm.
You have a vines in one claw, and the other claw you have a, you have 13 arrows.
Mm-hmm.
The secondary symbol of Ephraim. You have 13 stripes, red and white stripes, on the
mm-hmm.
banner. And you might just remind everybody that we started with 13 states.
13 feathers in the tail, 15, 13 leaves in the olive branch there.
Yeah, I think in the branch there's probably 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Yeah, I think so.
Yep.
So you can't get away from this stuff. Now, this is either the greatest coincidence in the history of mankind, or God gave us plenty of clues to find out who was doing what to whom and who they were. I mean,
mm-hmm.
he's never been secretive about this. He could not have exploited this early because he cursed them for 2,520 years, seven times curse. And if a prophetic year is 360 days, or even if you do it 365 and a quarter days, you still don't come to the 1800s where they could have actually discovered these things through archaeology. They found this, what they started calling the Celtics, and the Celtics were only called that because the Greeks coined the term Celtoids when all these masses of people that were leaving because of the Persians were allowing them to leave
mm-hmm.
up through the Caucasus and over through Greece. And that's where the term came from. It, identically, at the same time that almost a million people over the course of a year crossed over, and then a couple more million, you have a very, if you want to read your archaeology books, they can trace these Celtics. They'll just say they came from the Middle East somewhere. They trace these people all across northern Europe, settling in large quantities in Norway and all the way through Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
The Netherlands, Belgium, France,
mm-hmm.
and of course we had a good bit in Spain coming up from the other end, from Troy, and also from Egypt to begin with. You have, they all culminate, every tribe culminates, winds up in England and through Great Britain. And then that branch that breaks away from Great Britain, the United States, that's Manasseh. And if you trace all their symbols, I don't want to make a long story too short, but if you trace all their symbols, then you will find that they're all there, and they're the only people in the whole world that do it. And my thoughts are, and let me just show you some of the places they are. For Reuben, for instance, you find the Royal Coat of Arms in Denmark, which has all the same symbols on it. You have Greece, Iceland, Lapland, Sweden, and the Netherlands, and a few other places, but those are the primary ones. On Yehuda, you find the national emblem of the Royal House of England and the Royal House of Denmark. In Dan, you find them in Britain, the clans of Scotland, Netherlands, and Denmark. Now, I could add 25 more editions of smaller groups in this, but this is just the first place you can go and find these things. Ephraim is all the way through the Royal House of Britain. Manasseh is only found in large quantities in the United States.
So we're saying, I found the enemy, and the enemy is us. I mean, you're saying that as Europe becomes more anti-Semitic, for example, and so does America, that in fact it is it's parasitic. They are who they oppose.
Yeah. Think of it this way. This is where my thinking is, and it may be wrong. It may be
mm-hmm.
right. I'm pretty. It feels right. There's two huge group of people that became so powerful that they pushed the world around. England first.
Yes.
And they begat the United States. And they're still united, you know, in their close approximation. You have Ephraim and
mm-hmm.
Manasseh. And they pushed
yes.
the world around. They've exploited the peoples of the world.
Yes.
And without question, I know the Roman Catholic Church is a big, bad.
It doesn't say, but the Roman Catholic Church, it doesn't say the Roman Catholic Church pushed people around.
No,
it said it's tread upon them. It said the Yahweh's prophecy on them is they tread upon the whole world.
Yeah.
They stomp them down. Yeah, that's what the feudalistic system that Theodosius imposed on Europe for better part of 1,000 years, they tread upon people. They pushed them down.
They used all of Western Europe to do it, too.
Yes.
They used the French kings and the Spanish kings. My God, they had the Alma
Mater. Whereas the United States hasn't.
And on and on.
England and the United States hasn't tread upon people, pushed them around. Quite different.
Or reaches in the British Commonwealth. I mean, we've the British took over India. For goodness sake, they controlled every port all the way up to China. You couldn't move your tea out of China.
Right. And again, they didn't require the Indians to bow down to them, just like the Americans don't require people to bow down to them. They just push them around. They control them.
Yeah. These are sun-worshipping
Babylonian Christian nations,
worshiping people.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
They believe in their military.
Uh-huh.
Is their savior. They believe they have a right by God to do this.
Mm-hmm.
They sing praises to a God whose name they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And the religion that they gravitated to on all its different variations was Christianity, was Pauline Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they could have gotten it just through the Catholic Church and everything, but let's look at another avenue. This is. I read this years ago. I mean, years and years and years ago about Paul. And in Romans 15:24, it says, "I hope to see you in passing as I go to Spain." Everybody kind of stops on Paul because Acts stops on Paul in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
But he's there for 2 years. He's there freely coming and going, according to that, if you believe the book of Acts. And I don't care what it's true about. But it's
you know what's most amazing thing about the book of Acts? I just read this because there's Paul, Shaul is criticized in Yeshua 5. But I put together a host of people who recognized that Paul was a fraud. And the book of Acts is the very tool that is used to make this transition between Yeshua's disciples and Paul. That one grows out of the other as opposed to being in wholesale conflict with one another. It was very artfully done by an extraordinarily misguided man.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. My contention is that Yahweh never sent Paul anywhere. He hates
of course not. Oh, no, he hates his guts.
Free will being what it is, he's not going to stop him because you have to have. He let Satan walk right into the garden.
No, he did everything that he could do to warn us about him. He must mention Shaul and condemn him more than 100 times in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Yeah, mentions him by name and condemns him by name.
And once you understand he's the plague of death.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you find the plague, even the plague is in the 26th Leviticus.
Yeah, he is, by the way, when they talk about the number 666. That's Paul.
That's Paul.
Yeah, Chabaouk was revealed and specifically told that, you know, they know it's a long time before this is going to be fulfilled, but do not question whether or not this is going to happen as I'm telling you. It was exactly 666 years from the Chabaouk prophecy to Paul's first letter.
Galatia, letter to the Galatians.
That's correct.
Galatians. Consider this. He says he's going to Spain.
Mm-hmm.
Why would he want to go to Spain? Now, listen, first question I have to you is if the Christian concept of we need to go out and spread the masses to the Gentiles, well, why the heck didn't he turn right and go to Asia? There's millions there.
Right.
If he was trying to save soul, why didn't he go down to Africa?
But he wasn't.
He didn't, did he?
No, he was at war. He was at war with Jews.
Wherever they found Yehudim,
right,
and wherever they found old tribes of Israelites, worked his way to Rome. And then, why the heck would he stay there for 2 years? Would he have gone? Would he not have gone to the place where they are all hanging out in between Spain and Ireland and England?
Right.
People claim he did, but there was a document found. Now, I'm not saying it's true, but I haven't found anybody that argues with it. The reason it doesn't get a lot of press is because Roman Catholics don't want to hear about it because it puts an emphasis more on the British than it does on Rome. It's where Paul was.
Right.
But did you look that up? Did
no.
I send you that notation?
No.
Okay, this professor, E.J. Bicknell, King's College, and I read this years and years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Who translated this document, and it came from C.S. Sononi, who published it in 1790s, I think it was 94, and then he published again in 1797. It's called Sanini's Travels in Turkey and Greece. Now, he was a Frenchman. He was working, he was sponsored by the King Louis XVI, who reigned about 1774 through 1793. And when he was there, he found, when he was in Turkey, from the archives of Constantinople, he was presented to him by the Sultan Abdul Akhmet. He was traveling on behalf of the king. And he published his what he found in 1774, and then again it was 1793.
Mm-hmm.
Under the orders of the king, about a document called the Acts 29. It was the last chapter of Acts. And Bicknell translated in English. It sounds, it's a very Christianized thing, but it talks about Paul going to Spain and then Paul going to Rome, and that's the legend is that he was there. That's why they built the Paul's Cathedral, St. Paul's Cathedral there. And the part was he departed out of Rome. This is from the quote, from the translation, departed out of Rome, determined to go to Spain, for he had long time proposed to journey there and was minded to also go to Britain, is the line. And so he goes on and talks about him being there. That would make perfect sense to me, because if Satan really wanted to wrap up these people, if he really wants to cater these people and keep them under his thumb and spread Pauline Christianity,
mm-hmm.
where would he go? He would go where the greatest concentration of Israel is.
Correct.
The greatest concentration of Azarites. As I was trying to conclude this thing on why... I'm always trying to look for motives. What's wrong with these people? I mean, some of us are just stupid. We're lost for lack of knowledge, of course. But I went down the list of kings of or leaders of from Abraham all the way down to Dode.
Mm-hmm.
And then I looked up every one of them to see who they were and what tribe they were with as well. And it was interesting. You've got Abraham, of course, is Babylonian. He's not at all. He didn't come from Israel. And his sons came out of Sarah and him. Both of them came there. So they're not of a tribe in the sense of the 12 groups or 13 groups. If you go on down and keep on going down, when you have and then the first powerful king, when they're all taken into bondage and when they all go to Egypt and then later taken into bondage, is Ephraim. But he'd already promised long ago, you know, that they would get that Jacob had already promised that these would that Yehuda would be king, and he's not anywhere close to being a king yet. Then you go down to, or then you have Yosha. I mean, after Moshe, he's a lowly. The next big leader is Yosha. He takes him into the Promised Land. He's an Ephraimite. He's not Yehuda. You know what the first king is? Then we have Saul, of course. So you know what the first king is that actually fulfills the promise to Yehuda?
Dode. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's extended, I guess, if you want to count as Charlemagne.
Uh-huh.
And after that, you don't have a Yehuda king rulership ruling over all the tribes again till Dode returns. I just thought it was
right.
Interesting, you know. So he makes these promises, but everything is either something that's going to happen right
yeah.
away.
And that's how the scepter never passes, is that during the millennial Shabbat,
mm-hmm.
All of Israel is once again under the authority
one
of Dode.
Shepherd. I use the term shepherd more than king, because he was a shepherd king, if anything.
Right. Mm-hmm. He was.
Anything, but... So, you know, I can pick it apart with all the different verses and stuff
mm-hmm.
On what he promised and who he promised it to. But the bottom line is these are the people. And as we set up to the end time, the end battles and all, even Islam is weakened terribly if these people, these British European jerks and American
mm-hmm.
jerks, and nobody knows this better than you. You've done more research on these guys than anybody in the world. These jerks support these people to kill Israel.
Correct.
They arm them. They encourage them. They th- throw Yehuda, they throw Israel under the bus. They don't care. I mean, this is just, no wonder God hates you. Why wouldn't he? And America
Correct.
Won't wake up. And England won't wake up, and Europe won't wake up. And that little thing that Terry found and sent you about Spain and the rabbi in Spain. My gosh, you know, it's becoming.
Yes. Yeah, the timing of that was even interesting because I had just, the day before, I was trying to look up the proper spelling for the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. I'm not a good one at spelling sepulchre. You know, which I mean, the Church of the Holy Dead is probably a better way to say that, but the Church of the Dead, and I want to spell it correctly because there was this statement in Yeshaya 5 that indicated that there's going to be a real blight in the middle of Yahweh's garden, and when I was looking that up, I saw these pictures of all of these high-rise apartment buildings and condominium structures. And then what I saw was, then Yahweh said, you know, that the housing in Israel is going to be such that roofs are going to be attached to ceilings and walls to wall as people flood into the country. And so I looked at the email from your wife, Terry, and there was a rabbi saying, because of the influx of Muslims, it isn't safe for any Jew to live in Europe anymore. They need to return to Israel. And what God had just said in his prophecy is that, you know, if you're one of those that new arrival and living in one of these housing constructs, this is what you ought to expect. And it ain't pretty.
No.
It's horrible.
Kind of so real is right.
Oh, I know. It's and then you know to have two days imagery.
It's a nervous laugh. It's kind of a I'm not afraid. It's just everything I study, everything I read is this is exactly who these people are. You've got this triumphant of the British Commonwealth with America and all wrapped around with Paul's fingers, you know, and his nasty little hands and the whole thing on and telling you this is what God wants you to do.
Yeah. How many letters do you think Paul wrote?
It's like 13 of something, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's 13. Son of a gun.
Yeah, 30. Oh, yeah.
That same number, right? 13.
Yeah. Didn't think about that, yeah.
No, 13 letters.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I don't miss a trick.
No.
I'm sorry for it's a little choppy, but it's so much information, and it's just, but I read through it all. I the conclusions I'm doing, if anybody wants to go through and read those things, and then if you don't know, if you... When he tells you where to stand and where your standards are and where your banners are, that's Midbar 2:2, Numbers 2:2, and he'll tell you where to. He tells them to camp. He tells them to put their banners in front of them. It's pretty well known what their banners were, and then you just trace them. And guys, you don't find it anywhere else.
So what you're suggesting here is that because Yahweh speaks of so many people being influenced by them over such a long period of time, and then dealing with them in the end. That there are millions and millions of people throughout Europe and the Americas that are descendants from one of the 12 families of, or 13, if you count the Loi, of Israelites that just don't know it.
Don't have a clue.
That you and I, you know, I'm part Sioux Indian, but I'm also British and Scottish.
And, you know, most of us have some of that. And
or that could well be perhaps parts of Manasseh, parts of Dan, parts of you know, Yehuda.
And we can trace them back to my family, back to England, and my mother's side, even one going back to Spain. But it doesn't mean anything unless the covenant is open to everybody, and everybody hangs around you.
Well, it's only meaningful as it relates to these specific promises of who's doing what to whom and how they're fulfilling them and how they're going to be allotted territory and who is Yehuda and Israel in the last days, because there's a specific responsibility in a specific area that you'll be resettled versus just who's a Gentile adoptee. And those of us who consider ourselves Gentile adoptees may not, in fact, be.
maybe not, but I don't even care. You know, it's irrelevant to me. I'm just glad to be in the family. And just,
well, I do. I care only. I care for two reasons.
Oh,
one, yeah. One is that Yahweh has always he's the chosen people are Israelites and Yehudah in particular. So it is better, but it's not bad the other way around.
No.